Autofluorescence, the natural emission of light by biological structures, occurs in the retinal pigment epithelium when the fluorophores in lipofuscin produced by photoreceptors are stimulated. A new technology called fundus autofluorescence imaging has been developed to allow more accurate detection of autofluorescence in the eye, with the aim of identifying retinal diseases when these are not otherwise evident. Here, Susan Cowling asks community optometrist Simon Browning about autofluorescence in the eye and the implications of the new imaging technology for a wide range of ocular health issues.
Hi, Simon. To begin, what is autofluorescence?
Well, literally, autofluorescence is the natural emission of light by biological structures, such as mitochondria and lysosomes, when they've absorbed light. Within the eye, we've been aware of these properties for some time now, but have not really made use of these properties until recently. Traditionally, one of the problems in trying to view retinal components using standard methods has been the natural fluorescent properties of the crystalline lens. However, with the arrival of confocal scanning laser ophthalmoscopes using laser light, this problem has been eradicated. We now can make use of this very dynamic way of viewing retinal structures.
So how does this phenomena occur in the eye?
Well, the rods and cones in the retina are embedded into the retinal pigment epithelium at their photoreceptor disc end. Now, I know this is probably going to upset my old anatomy lecturers and the purists amongst us, but when explaining the phenomenon to patients, I describe the rods and cones as a pile of CDs with a lollipop stick on the top. It's the CDs that are embedded into the RPE layer. These CDs, the photoreceptor disc, as they fatigue, drop off into the RPE cells, where they're broken down by the process of phagocytosis, and they're disposed of through the natural waste disposal system of the body. Now, it's this breakdown that gives rise to the product lipofuscin, and in particular lipofuscin A2E, and this is a natural fluorophore. If the lipofuscin is stimulated by the correct wavelength of light, it's going to emit light as fluorescence. Now, lipofuscin has a broad spectrum of excitation between 300 and 600 nanometers, and also an emission between 480 and 800 nanometers.
Why might it be useful to measure ocular autofluorescence?
Well, as I said, the breakdown of the photoreceptors is a natural part of the normal metabolism of the eye. Viewing the presence and appearance of the amount of lipofuscin produced gives us a direct correlation to the metabolic functioning of the eye in real time. Put simply, we can observe in real time the fitness of the RPE layer, and hence its ability to actually perform its task and allow normal photoreceptor function. We're viewing in real time the functioning of the retinal pigment epithelium, and hence viewing the active stress levels of the retina. In viewing these stress levels, we can make judgments as to how the retina is functioning, often before permanent damage is done, and often before any changes are visible in standard imaging, which traditionally looks at the structure of the retina as opposed to the function. This allows us to often intervene and show the patient the active stress that is on their retina. This, I find, is a really strong wake-up call to people such as smokers or people with very poor diet, for instance. It opens the opportunities to discuss lifestyle and diet with these patients in an effort to turn around their unhealthy lifestyle. Also, presence of lipofuscin can be associated with leakage due to more sinister lesions, such as melanomas. Signs of hyperfluorescence over what may appear to be just a simple nevus may well direct the optometrist to a much more rapid referral, and the report of such autofluorescent activity would quite probably influence the speed with which a patient may be seen by the ophthalmologist. This is increasing the accuracy and timing of a relevant referral. Clearly, also the presence of lipofuscin in the macular region can show signs of macular stress and enable the clinician to open a dialogue with the patient as to lifestyle. With the now accepted link of obesity and smoking to macular degeneration, it's vital to have a tool such as autofluorescence to be able to demonstrate the changes to the retina to these groups of patients. Often, a retina may look healthy on a normal colour image, which, as I said before, is only looking at the structure of the retinal elements. But an autofluorescent image that looks at the function may show a completely different story. It's also highly relevant that in the last few weeks, the University of Leicester has published results of research that may well prove highly significant down the line in the treatment and prevention of diseases such as Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Their research has shown ways to literally stop brain cell death. Admittedly, in the moment, it's only in mice, but it will be transferable, according to them, in time. The method, of course, doesn't regenerate those cells. So if treatment success is to be maximised for an individual, it's absolutely vital to be able to detect those changes to the cells at the very earliest stage. Earlier research has shown a definitive link between the decay of far peripheral retinal cells and this decay of actual brain cells. Thus, the peripheral retina becomes a highly valuable diagnostic indicator, possibly enabling treatment of brain cell damage at a very, very early stage. Considering we're now able to view the far peripheral retina without dilation, this comes within the scope of an optometrist's routine examination. Of course, there's going to be ethical issues about these results that will need to be further discussed. But this is a tremendously exciting time and will mean that yet again, optometry is well established to take on the new roles. In future, routine imaging of the peripheral retina should become a norm as these new treatments come online.
How exciting. So what methods have been used to measure autofluorescence up till now?
Typically, due to the difficulties of obtaining easy images, fundus autofluorescence imaging was traditionally a hospital-based exercise, and it generally consisted of use of traditional fundus camera imaging, using fundus cameras equipped with excitation and barrier filters for fluorescein angiography to document the highly fluorescent ocular structures, such as optic nerve head drusen, with high ISO film or monochromatic digital sensors. However, due to very low levels of fluorescence, results were often very inconsistent and unreliable.
So, how does this improved technology for fundus autofluorescence imaging actually work?
Well, it's really been with the advent of confocal scanning laser ophthalmoscopes that autofluorescent imaging has become an everyday possibility. This system of imaging creates a virtual image in space, which can then be scanned. The laser used delivers a very narrow wavelength band, allowing for efficient excitation of the fluorescence. A confocal aperture blocks non-image forming light from reaching the image detector, and this minimizes scatter and improves the contrast. The confocal design also prevents fluorescence in the crystalline lens from interfering with retinal fluorescence. Several frames will be captured at one time with the confocal scanning laser ophthalmoscope. These are then aligned and averaged to reduce the noise in the background and to increase the exposure. The technique uses a laser with an excitation wavelength of 488 nanometers and a barrier filter at 500 or 520 nanometers. Now, new filter sets have also been developed for fundus camera-based systems, allowing easier imaging with autofluorescence. They utilise high-sensitivity monochrome digital sensors, along with different wavelength combinations than those used for fluorescein angiography. Monochrome sensors are generally considered better than their colour counterparts for retinal autofluorescence. The digital fundus camera technique, first described by Spade, employs an excitation filter centred at about 580 nanometers and a barrier filter around 695 nanometers. These wavelengths are deliberately shifted towards the red end of the spectrum to avoid unwanted short wavelength autofluorescence from the crystalline lens. A second generation of autofluorescent filter sets are now commercially available for some fundus camera-based systems. The excitation filter has a bandpass range of about 535 to 585 nanometers, and the barrier filter has a bandpass range of about 605 to 715 nanometers. These are proprietary filters, and they avoid excitation of both the crystalline lens and fluorescein. They improve light transmission, and they reduce the background noise.
And how was it developed?
Well, the system that's most widely available nowadays is the Optos Daytona scanning laser ophthalmoscope. The various Optimap systems have been available for over 10 years now and are used widely across the world. The wide-field imaging system makes use of two wavelengths of laser light, the red wavelength to look at the deeper layers of the retina and the green wavelength to look at the surface structures of the retina. Now, the green wavelength is also at a level that is suitable for autofluorescent imaging, and hence it was just a natural transition to further develop the imaging to incorporate the autofluorescent ability.
What advantages does this technique offer compared to older methods?
Well, the Daytona system allows an image to be taken through an undilated pupil right the way down to 2 millimetres. It's quick, straightforward, and can be used with patients as young as 2 to 3 years old. It's also easier for the older patient to cope with, and hence in older patients where age-related changes are far more common, it's a vital tool. Traditional imaging looks at the structure of the retina, whereas autofluorescent imaging is looking at the function of the retinal elements. Therefore, we're able to view in real time how the retina is coping with its everyday function. Older methods that rely on the optometrist assuming normal retinal function just cannot give an accurate view of what is really happening within the retina. Given the complexity and problems related to earlier systems, they were often only hospital-based, whereas this new technology is readily citable on the high street. And without the need for dilation, the process is quick and doesn't inconvenience the patient, as they can still drive afterwards and return to work immediately afterwards. It's also very quick and easy to incorporate within a normal time span for an eye examination. The imaging is easy, and therefore a practice clinical assistant can be trained to take the images, thereby leaving the optometrist free to carry out the image analysis with the patient, meaning that the clinician's time is not taken up just taking the images.
So when would you envisage it being appropriate for optometrists to use the technology?
Well, the question is sort of aimed at which patients would you routinely use it on? And the simple answer I would give is, if at all possible, all of them. I'm not in favour of doing tests just for the sake of it, and I do often feel that some tests are done just because they can be done. The machinery is there, so I'm going to use it. However, autofluorescent imaging is very different. All the other procedures are looking at the structure of the retina, whereas autofluorescent imaging looks at the function of the retina and hence can give a view of future retinal degradation. This hasn't been done before when we look at the structure, so it's an entirely different approach. I've imaged many retinas that on the colour structural scan appeared totally normal, but on autofluorescent scanning show a completely different story. Often these functional retinal changes open up topics of conversation, such as the patient's diet, their weight, their body mass index, whether they smoke or not, and the need to quit smoking. I have on many occasions looked at retinas that show hyperfluorescence in and around the macular region in younger patients who demonstrate poor diet or are overweight, or both. This hyperfluorescence demonstrates the retina is under stress and will eventually lead to cellular dropout in the retina.
And how do you see this technology fitting into an optician's diagnostic toolset?
Well, this technology fits very easily into the overall toolset. It performs a different function to the other tools, in that it's looking at function. It's a vital adjunct to the other tools. I've often seen areas of hyperfluorescence on the retina that, when we look at them with an OCT, show areas of marked persistent vitreous attachment. It's clear that using these tools in tandem, one can demonstrate the impact of the vitreous forces on the underlying RPE. This allows for a far more dynamic appraisal of the situation for the patient. On many occasions, I'm able to show patients how they've continued retinal stress and how, therefore, it's vital for them to look after their retinas. I currently have a man who I noted a macular melanoma in. It was picked up very early when he was asymptomatic and had 6/4 vision in that eye. He's since had radiotherapy plaque treatment and the tumour is treated. His best corrected visual acuity remains good at 6/5. However, the autofluorescent images show a clear area of marked hyperfluorescence centrally, with now some tiny patches of hypofluorescence. But this means I can show him that these changes are definitely there, and that they're progressive, and he is now well prepared for the inevitable visual loss that will occur over time. Furthermore, autofluorescence allows me, by dint of the reducing quality of image, to ascertain the real extent of visual loss as cataracts develop. Many optometrists will have encountered the patient who complains of excessive glare and problems with night driving due to the glare of headlights, and yet they actually, within the consulting room, demonstrate quite good visual acuity. So sometimes it's difficult to make a case for surgery easily. However, when a cataract is viewed with slit lamp, and then you look at the poor quality autofluorescent image as well, it's often a lot more easy to make that case for the early surgery to happen. With autofluorescence, it's always important to remember that by default, other structures are viewed differently, and therefore, fundi with diabetic retinopathy often show incident hemorrhaging far more easily.
So in conclusion, what do you think the implications might be on the way optometrists treat and advise their patients?
Well, as I said earlier, I think the implications are potentially immense. I think I've demonstrated how viewing autofluorescent images means we're no longer just looking at that structure of the eye, but we can look at the real-time functioning of the elements within the retina. This puts us into an entirely new game, in that we can intervene much earlier in a patient's lifestyle to attempt to bring them back to a much healthier way of living. It also allows for much more informed, targeted referrals to ophthalmology. I know I discuss images that I'm not sure of with local ophthalmologists, And this has actually made for a much more enhanced working relationship. I see optometrists as a much better place to inform patients and advise patients. But more than that, I see the optometrist as the head of a team within the practice, whose role it is to care for the patient with a much greater sort of holistic approach. I see the optometrist as the leader of a team who will be advising patients on healthy diet, use of dietary supplements where appropriate, who will be trained in stop smoking management, who will be trained to take blood pressure readings and BMI measurements, things like that, and then share this information with the patient's GP in a joint health partnership. This is already done very widely in the USA, and I'm actually very pleased to say that it's something our clinical commissioning group is looking at as a natural extended role for optometrists. And of course, finally, given this very exciting research from Leicester, I see optometrists in the future right at the very forefront of early intervention into one of the most devastating and cruel groups of illnesses, including dementia and Alzheimer's disease. The optometrist is a vital member of the primary care team whose role more and more nowadays is focused on wellness, illness prevention. With readily usable tools like autofluorescence now being available, whereby we can examine and detect changes in the function of the retina long before actual damage occurs, we as optometrists are ideally placed to fulfil that role of wellness maintenance.
Thank you, Simon and Susan.